You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks.
Bye.
Hello, lovely listeners. Here we are with another episode of Sex Gets Real. It's just going to be you and me and porn and listener questions this week. I also wanted to mention that once again, Lola is sponsoring this week's episode. Lola is a subscription-based service that sends you, in these really pretty little boxes, pads and tampons for your period. So if you or someone in your household needs pads and or tampons, Lola is 100% organic, it's woman-owned, they send it to you automatically so you don't have to remember to go shopping. You can actually customize exactly what kinds of tampons or what kinds of pads you get so that it fits you perfectly. I actually customized mine pretty heavily so that I could get exactly the things that I wanted. And they are generously offering 60% off your first order. You just have to go to mylola.com and enter promo code SGR for Sex Gets Real. And that gets you 60% off that first order that you get. So I hope you check it out. They've been so generous in supporting the show. And of course, you can't beat not having to go shopping for your pads and tampons when they just show up at your door in a pretty little box and you know they're organic. I also wanted to mention that every other week, I'm still doing my Sex is a Social Skill group calls. We have another one coming up soon. You can check out the link at sexgetsreal.com/EP179 for this episode, or check out the show notes. We talk about all sorts of stuff. Last time we talked about the intersection of shame and desire. Like, what do you do when you have shame around some of the things that you want? And we've talked about anger. We've talked about being cherished. This coming call is going to be all about erotica and kind of writing out our sexual interests and fantasies. It should be a fun, interactive little call. So totally check that out if you want to practice saying new things and thinking new thoughts and just connecting with super awesome people. It's kind of like hanging out at a book club or a coffee shop, but we do it online. So I'd love to see you there. Okay, so the past 2 weekends, I have actually seen a lot of erotic material because I attended the 3-day Seattle Erotic Film Fest down in Seattle. And then just last night here in Vancouver, I actually went to see Hump, which is the Dan Savage Film Festival. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about it. The Seattle Erotic Film Festival, they were so generous and they made it really affordable. It was in this really great kind of old-timey theater in Seattle. And they had films showing for 3 days. What I will say is a lot of the films and the aesthetic were so not my cup of tea. And if nothing else, I really learned that. The very first film that we went to see was called Picture of Beauty. And it comes out of Poland. And it opened with a 20-minute short from Portugal called The Debutante. And it was interesting because both of the films were, you know, by white men who, I think the first one was made by white men, I'm not sure, but I know for sure the second one is. And it just felt very male gazy, you know, like these thin white young women frolicking through fields. It had a terrible story arc. There were so many like loose ends, and I don't know that porn always has to have a story. And if it's gonna have a story, I think it either needs to be really campy and just kind of acknowledge like we're really just here for the sex, so we're kind of making up a story, or it needs to be great. And this was an attempt to be great, but it failed miserably. So it was kind of eye-rolling, honestly, for me. And I hesitate to say that it was beautiful because it was kind of tropey in the beautiful, right? We were looking at green fields and then these very thin, very young white cis women would like frolic through the fields. And then there was an artist who was obsessed with painting beauty. And of course, it was these very thin, naked, white, young, able-bodied cis women. And so it just didn't move me. It wasn't interesting. It wasn't different. And we went to a set of experimental films. The vast majority of those felt really difficult to sit through. It was either flashing images where you couldn't even really truly see what you were looking at. You just got the impression that it was nudity of some sort, but you couldn't actually see the body parts or see the motion or see the activity. It was just, you know, kind of like, of course, again, white people flesh, like beigey skin, just kind of like in movement that didn't mean anything. And there was a couple like that. And I so support people doing their art in the ways that they want to. This was not for me. I felt frustrated and like there was no context. There was nothing to move me. There was nothing that interested me. So what went well? There was a short during the Future Sex shorts called Cake. And Cake is actually by a filmmaker who works for HBO. She cuts trailers for Game of Thrones and The Young Pope. She's done a whole bunch of commercials. Her short was 9 minutes long. You can actually see the trailer. I've linked to it at sexgetsreal.com and for this episode. And it was just this really cute, you know, succinct story that was a couple who bought a sex robot, and Anne actually plays the sex robot in this film, and how they desperately want to like spice things up, but how wrong things can go when you don't quite know what you're asking for. It was hysterical. Every single detail in the film was spot on. It was simple and beautifully shot, and even had some smart kind of like racial jokes in it. And it was just beautifully done from start to finish. And then there was another one in the Future shorts called Boner Loner that I loved. It was about a future where this guy who, you know, certainly isn't your traditional porn guy. He's super hairy and he's, you know, got a little bit of a belly and he's a little bit geeky and he's about to have a hookup and he realizes he can't get hard. And so he calls Boner Loner up, and literally Boner Loner is a company that just loans you a boner for whatever activity you're about to have. And so they send over a boner, which is actually this guy who's kind of very robotic, but he has a hard cock. And so the geeky guy's date shows up and she's like, "Oh wow, you got a boner loner." And he's like, "Yeah, only the best for you." And so the boner loner fucks her like 17 different ways. And at the end, the boner loner goes away. And then the geeky guy's the hero and she tells him how amazing he is. And it's kind of this like infomercial feel. It's very tongue-in-cheek. It knows it's being ridiculous throughout. But I just loved the message of thinking outside the box to find a way to please a lover who's coming over and then getting to be the hero when it wasn't his cock that was the one that was actually doing some of the sex. And yeah, it was just really funny. Some of the filmmakers were actually in the audience. And then we saw a series of shorts called It's Complicated. And those are actually the best of the festival. There was a really sweet little lesbian consent film that was like hot and flirty and cute. And at the end, it was all about consent. There was a very funny instructional video, kind of made like those 1950s instructional videos where there's a narrator that's kind of talking to the people on screen. Like, wouldn't you like to date couples too? And then they smile and nod. And it's called How to Date Couples. And it's just this funny, cute little film kind of making fun of a lot of the bad things that happen when you first decide you want to date a couple. And then, you know, what happens when you actually meet a couple you like and how to make that successful. So it was kind of a mixed bag for me. I think what became very clear after watching all of these films was, you know, it's important to me, at least, I'm not saying it has to be important to you, but it's important to me that there's a point, that it's not just the same old thing, you know, that it's not just hypermasculinity or hyperfemininity without being aware that it is, you know, like if you're aware you're doing that and you're kind of using that trope for a reason, then I think that that self-awareness can be really hot and interesting. And then we saw the Dan Savage Hump Festival, which one of the really fun things about that festival, if you've never been, is that all of the films have to be 5 minutes or less. So that means no matter what you see, no matter how much you love it or hate it, you don't have to sit through it for more than 5 minutes. There were, I don't know, 24 films that we saw in a 2-hour period. For the most part, they were really funny and smart. Many of them didn't have actual sex. They just kind of made fun of sex or simulated sex. There was an animated film. There was a song about sock puppets, something that that did kind of scar me just a little bit is at the Seattle Erotic Film Festival, the It's Complicated Shorts program actually had 2 scat play videos. And one of them was surprisingly well done. It was this funny gay instructional video that was kind of highlighting all of the tropes from gay male culture. And it was really cute and really funny and kind of moved you through the fashion and flagging and how they hook up and the different activities they do. And then the very end, after they had done some fisting and some piss play, they did a little teeny like scat scene. And it's kind of intentionally like they're looking at the camera and they're kind of acknowledging like, yes, we went there. We're pushing your buttons. There was another video that is called Breakfast in Bed. And for me, it's challenging to watch. And that film actually showed up at the Hump Festival too. And so I had to see it twice in 1 week. And at least the second time I knew to close my eyes because it wasn't for me, but it was certainly fun listening to the audience react to it. The Hump films were a big range. I think the thing that disappointed me the most is, you know, the Hump Festival does awards. And so there's best humor, there's best kink, there's best sex, and then there's kind of overall. The 2 that won for best sex and runner-up best sex were 2 of the only films in the 24-film lineup that had white, thin, young, able-bodied sports couples having sex. And so the winner was a couple who'd hiked up to the top of a mountain and did some acro yoga, and then they fucked, and they were super thin, white, athletic, outdoorsy folks. And then the runner-up was almost the exact same thing of 2 white, athletic, young, able-bodied folks, or at least white passing. The woman maybe was Latinx, but it's hard to tell. They were, you know, having sex in lots of different adventurous places. And not that it wasn't hot, but there was lots of other sex happening. There was so much trans sex happening, and some of the trans sex was really hot. There was this one scene between 2 trans women who were like hardcore fucking, and it was really hot. I will say the best in show, though, was this wonderful little short called I'm Not Polly, But My Boyfriends Are. And it's about this woman who, they tell you at the end of the film that everyone featured in the film was between the ages of 51 and 75. And so it's this older woman who late in life kind of discovered that she was allowed to explore her body and have sexual pleasure. And so now she has four boyfriends, and she doesn't like to call herself Polly, even though, you know, all of the boyfriends kind of agree that's what they do. And the film is their bodies having these wonderful conversations with the camera and then engaging in sex, and it won Best in Show. And so that felt really good. There were some fucking hysterical films. So the new Hump Tour in Seattle, which is where it kicks off, actually starts next month. So I got to see the very tail end of the films that have been circulating since October 2016, which means in, I think, October 2017, that's when the newest films premiere out in Seattle and Portland. So if you haven't had a chance to do that, I highly recommend it. I know they go out to DC and down to LA and up to Vancouver. It might take a couple months, but totally check it out. It'll give you so much to talk about and to giggle over and enjoy. Okay, so enough about my porn viewing. Let's jump into some listener questions. So the first is from JNIX. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, so I'll just spell it. And it asks me to define a word that I use, which is cis. So this is a word that has become more and more popular, and I'm glad you're asking. And it's a way of denoting whether or not your gender aligns with the sex that people just kind of call out when you're born. So you know how when a doctor pulls a baby out, they say, "It's a girl." That's because they've looked at the genitals and decided that that is what both your gender and your sex are, entirely based on your genitals. So if you're a person where when you got pulled out and they declared, "It's a girl," and as you grow up, your gender is as a woman, so they align, then that means you're cis. If you were declared, "It's a girl," but as you grow up, realized your gender was something else, maybe your gender is masculine or male, then you'd be referred to as potentially trans. You might be gender nonconforming or non-binary. There's lots of different ways that we experience our gender versus our genitals. But cis is just a way of kind of acknowledging that what people saw between your legs and declared your sex aligns also with the way that you feel in your body, and it aligns with that. So you inherently, because of our world and unfortunately the way that we organize around binaries right now, means that you're born with a lot of privilege. People just kind of assume that everyone in the world is cis, unless they're told otherwise. That's a privilege. You don't have to do all that extra work and emotional labor of correcting people or telling them that that's not the case. So I hope that's helpful to you. There's so many amazing resources out there. If you want to learn more, Scarlatine is a great place to go. And then of course, any website that talks about like queer rights or trans rights, transstudent.org has some resources with definitions. So I hope you'll check that out and also give it a think, you know, whether or not you're cis, what does that mean for you and how you move through the world? Okay, the next email is from Shane, and it says, "Please help with spanking. Hey, Dawn, I've been listening to all of your past episodes since finding this podcast recently, and I love it. I love you. I would totally sleep with you. I came out as a lesbian a few years back, and now I'm dating a sexy school teacher. Just one problem. I'm super into giving spankings and floggings. It turns me on and makes me soaking wet. But my girlfriend isn't really into it because she thinks it will just hurt. What can I do? Love you, Shane." Thank you so much for writing in, Shane, and thank you for listening to the show. I appreciate all of the love. The very first time I encountered vlogging was actually, oh God, I don't know, 15, 12, maybe 12 years ago in Washington, D.C. And I was going to these monthly dyke school nights at the Eagle, which is the gay male leather bar in DC, the Eagle. But at the time, every month on a Sunday, they were having a dyke night or a lesbian night where there would be group classes. And then afterwards, you know, we'd drink and mingle and do whatever people do in leather bars. So there was one night when we learned lap dancing, and that was really fun because all of the like butch and masculine identified folks were invited to sit in chairs in a circle. And then all of the feminine folks who wanted to participate, femme folks, got to actually practice giving lap dances to different people. And that was a really fun evening. And so they did all kinds of different things. And one of the classes was actually on flogging. And so my friend and I decided, well, we should go. We've never heard of this thing. And so they did a demo. And then everyone got a flogger. And we had a chance to actually try it ourselves. I think because it was new and I had never done it before and I was doing it with a friend that I did not have a sexual relationship with and we didn't really know what we were doing, I didn't really love it. Even though it was a really soft flogger, she was so tense and nervous that when I flogged her, she kind of freaked out and was like, oh, too much, too much, too much. And so I just assumed like, wow, this must be something that's pretty extreme because I was barely touching her with it. And then when she did it to me, you know, accuracy and where you hit is important. And so it was a little all over the place and I kind of maybe liked it, but it was just too stressful. And so I was like, I don't know if this is for me. It took a couple of years of, you know, seeing it other places and then having other people try it on me before I realized, like, I fucking love it. Now, I have not been flogged by one of those really mean floggers that has, like, rope knots at the end or really, really stiff leather. The floggers that I have and that we have are pretty soft and thuddy and thick. But for me, it's one of my favorite ways to just get embodied and to kind of escape and get really present and to turn off my brain. I love being flogged. It's like a massage. And I also love flogging. Hearing that thud and hearing the groan on the other side of pleasure. And, you know, one of the things that I love so much about the floggers that we have is we can wail on the other person. And at no point does it actually hurt in a stingy way, right? It just feels like these really solid thuds that just kind of feel like a really intense massage. And it makes your skin all warm and tingly and just kind of wakes you up to new sensations in your body. And then spanking, of course, you know, I've had bad experiences with spanking where the person just kind of like laid into me. I had a terrible experience once where I had just met someone at a munch and he offered to do a little scene with me and he spanked me pretty mercilessly and then slapped me across the face without negotiating that. And that really pissed me off. So of course, like anything, you know, you can customize an activity to exactly what you want. Spankings can hurt like fuck. You can bruise the shit out of someone and leave huge handprints. But they can also be these really fun, teasing, fluttery little experiences that just kind of make you gasp and make your skin a little warm, but don't actually hurt or sting too much. So the thing with your girlfriend is we never want to pressure someone into something. We never want to coerce someone into something. We don't want to make them feel like they have to do something on our behalf. So I think instead having some open conversations and asking her if it's okay to have the conversations, right? Another thing to keep in mind is often people are scared to have conversations about sexual or kinky activities because the assumption is if we start talking about this, then there's the potential you're going to want to follow through on it. Like, what if we start talking and then you decide now this means we can do it. So I think it's really helpful to approach a conversation with like, hey, I'd really love to do this yes, no, maybe list, or you can play my sex maps game. It's only $9 if you don't have it already. And it's just a little PDF that you download that helps you ask really fun questions of each other in new ways around sex and kink. But, you know, just say like, hey, I'd really love to talk to you about like things that turn you on and fantasies and things that turn me on. And I'd love for us to just do this someday, like on a date or in the park, so we can just talk, no pressure, like sex doesn't have to follow it or anything like that. And then just get really curious, like, what are your thoughts around this? And what makes you think that it's going to hurt? And what if you did it to me first? Would that be interesting to you? Just so that you can kind of have an experience of topping and trying this out. And, you know, would you be interested in watching any films or listen to this podcast together? And just kind of see what she thinks. She's allowed to be scared of it and to not want to do it. Sometimes it takes time of people just kind of sitting with an idea before they soften into it. And oftentimes when people hear me say it takes time, they think a couple of days or a couple of weeks. No, ideas and the ways that we feel about them can take months for people to just kind of slowly ease into. So let her have her path, and also just invite curiosity. Let her ask you questions about your experiences and the sensations that you have. And in the meantime, if you can enjoy some spanking porn and some flogging porn, and masturbate to fantasies of it, you know, I think that can be a really fun, juicy way to just stay in touch with that kinky side of yourself. But the key is really going to be just inviting open curiosity and let her know that if at any point she decides she is really curious, that it's absolutely possible to do flogging without pain. And you can even just drape the flogger on her. I think that's the thing too with kink that a lot of people don't get is they kind of go to the most extreme. So if someone hears whipping, they think like 12 years of slave whipping or big bloody bruises whipping, because that's often what we see in kink porn or in erotica playing out, right? So we don't really have a context for maybe when we play with the whip, we use it to restrain you, or I just trail it over your body, or we do the softest of flicks over your clothes so that you get that little risk feeling, but actually no pain sensation. Just approach it sensitively. And I'm sure that over the course of time, that curiosity is just going to naturally blossom. So good luck. Thank you for listening to the show. Feel free to share this episode with your girlfriend, and maybe that will also add some curiosity to the mix so that you can have some talks about it, because I am definitely a convert. I love flogging and spanking now, but it did take me some time to get there and to kind of retell some of the stories. Thank you so much, Shane. So Marissa wrote in, and I think this is a nice follow-up question to Shane's, and it says, this could be a good question for your podcast or just in general if you don't mind pointing me to some resources. I've recently gotten into being restrained and I love it. I'm wondering if I do it too often, will it lose some of its thrill? Is this inevitable? How can I keep it exciting? Is keeping it rare and special the secret? Thanks, Marissa. Those are wonderful questions. Specifically, if you're really into being restrained, I highly recommend checking out Emily Bingham's book, Diary of a Rope Slut. I just had her on the show a couple of months ago, so it might be worth just listening to the episode. But the book itself has, I don't know, God, like 15 or 20 chapters all about her rope adventures over many years. And at this point, she's been doing rope for probably like 10 or 15 years. I think she says in the book, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's still something that she loves doing. Like anything, whether it's monogamy and our partners, or it's polyamory, or it's being restrained, or it's writing erotica. The ways that we approach these things kind of set the tone, right? So whether we're talking about being in relationship with someone or really loving a specific activity, if we have a very, very, very specific way of wanting to do that thing and then reaching a point where we assume we kind of know everything or there's only one way to do it, the chances that we're going to fall into a rut and feel bored are pretty high. But if we approach things from this kind of curiosity mindset of realizing we will never truly know our partner. They are mysteries. Even when we think we know everything about them, they are still fully contained human beings that are constantly changing, whether we see it or not. So there's this like beautiful kind of sense of risk and curiosity that opens when we realize we'll never truly know someone. There's always going to be something about them that's shifting. And the same can be true for things like being restrained or liking impact play. There's always something new that we can discover. Our bodies are constantly changing. The way that rope and restraints feel when we're maybe in our 20s, it's going to feel differently when we're in a body in our early 40s or late 50s, because our body is changing. The context is changing. Where we do it is changing. Maybe the people we're doing it with changing. Maybe the types of things we're being restrained with change. So I think there is something important to know that when you ask, will it lose some of its thrill? There probably will come a point when it feels less new and when it feels less risky or taboo, right? Because once you've done something 10,000 times, you probably have grappled with some shame. You've probably grappled with it feeling like something you shouldn't be doing or like something that's super new. But in that place, you can start finding wonder and excitement at the endless possibilities. So those feelings may shift a little bit, but it doesn't have to mean that it becomes boring or dull unless that's how you're approaching it. So whether you're talking about restraints or you're talking about a partner that you've been with for, you know, 30 years, the way that you stay open and curious and just noticing the constant change, the constant opportunity for new information, for new discovery, that's where we stay in joy and in excitement and in connection. It can still feel special years later when you create these beautiful rituals around it and meaning. So I think it just depends on what kind of a person you are, Marissa. Like if you're the kind of person that knows how to kind of stay in wonderment, if you are open to finding lots of different materials and ways of being restrained, if you know how to check in with your body and notice the changes every single time you do it, then it can continue to feel fresh and exciting and new. But if you're the kind of person that tends to get bored rather easily, kind of staying in that curious mindset isn't something that you've really tried before or done before, then maybe it'll lose some of its luster. But I also think like the ways that we relate to these things when they shift, it's not always a bad thing, right? Like we are a culture that tells us that keeping things new and exciting and thrilling is the best way to do things. So we're kind of culturally told that having the same type of sex in the same position all the time is quote unquote boring. And then the assumption is that that's bad. But what if it's not? What if going from thrilling and special and exciting, it moves into comforting and nurturing and soul feeding and connected and pleasurable and a place to just surrender. So maybe that like heart pumping thrill is gone, but instead you're being fed in other ways. I think that can be an amazing thing too. So my recommendation to you, Marissa, is play with being restrained as often as feels good for you. And also, start thinking about all the ways that this could be new forever, if that's an important thing to you. If it's not, or if you're just open to kind of seeing what happens, there is absolutely nothing wrong with something moving from thrilling to comforting, to safe and enjoyable, to normal and a part of your everyday life. That can be just as nourishing and fulfilling as thrilling and exciting. It just looks a little bit different. So enjoy to your heart's content and do whatever it is that you want to do for as long as you want to do it. And then just stay curious. What is it feeling like to me now? I've been doing this for 6 months. I've been doing this for 6 years. I've been doing this for 16 years. How does it feel for me in all these different bodies and positions? And enjoy. That's the point of why we do all of this. So good luck. Congratulations on just recently getting into being restrained. I hope that there are all kinds of really interesting experiences ahead of you, and have fun. So I got this email from Hopelessly Devoted to Boot. And the subject line is Boot Fetish Ruins a Marriage. So here's the message. Hi, your show is so awesome. I just discovered it and started burning through the episodes. Thanks so much. I am all about a sex positive outlook, and you guys are so great that way. I've been happily married to my best friend for 20 years. We are nuts about each other. The thing is, I have an insanely powerful boot fetish that has been challenging in our relationship. I've bought my wife dozens of pairs of really expensive boots. Cheap boots turn me off. For the first 5 years, she wore boots all over, all of my favorite kinds. One of my big things is going into public places on a boot date with her. I love it when she wears thigh boots to dinner parties or shopping. It usually ends in massive sex at the end of the night because it's like hours of foreplay for me. I know it sounds selfish, but I can't help it. But little by little, she stopped accommodating my fetish. She would find excuses like, oh, we're going to have to stand a long time and I can't wear heels. And more excuses over the years led to more and more aggravation. The thing that sucks is we're best friends in all other areas of our lives. Note, I love all boot styles, not just heels. I like biker boots, wedge boots, whatever. So there are plenty of choices for her. She also has an awesome sense of style, so she always looks more like Vogue magazine. I think she's just over it. She even told me she gave away a pair that was one of my all-time favorites. I get so hard by certain pairs on her. Boots do nothing for me unless they are on a woman. Then it's magic. Now I have to spend my private time looking at thousands of celebrities in boots on celebboot.com, where I can see high-end boots on women. Consequently, my sex life with my wife has all but died. I mean, I would always accommodate her sexual needs while she was wearing boots. It was my Viagra. It never failed to get me hard. I was putty in her hand when she had boots on. What should I do? I'm stuck. Thanks. Well, first of all, thank you for writing in and for listening, Hopelessly Devoted to Boot. I definitely hear the pain and the stuckness in what you're sharing. And I think that it's really tough. One of the things that stands out to me is when we have fetishes, one of the toughest things is fetishes often dehumanize the person that's helping us to live out that fetish. So whether we're fetishizing a person because of how they look, maybe because they're in a fat body or they have a disability, we're fetishizing boots or latex or t-shirts, because I just recently had a guy write in who has a fetish for t-shirts, especially with bubble letters on it. The danger is that the fetish becomes so powerful that we forget about the people, that they are complex human beings with complex feelings and sexualities of their own. And while some people really love being fetishized, or being part of a fetish. Other people, myself included, don't like that feeling of kind of lost humanity. And so I'm wondering if you've asked your wife directly what it was like for her to learn about your boot fetish, to have you buy all these boots for her, to wear all of these boots for as many years as she did, and then to really honestly find out what changed. Did she start to feel like it was more about the boots and not about her? Was she feeling invisible? Even if you were pleasuring her, even if the sex was really hot, if she didn't feel like it was for her, it was because of her, because of how she looked or because of how she smelled or because of the things she wanted, but because of the boots, there may be a chance that she was just feeling like an object, a thing to fill the boots so that you could get off. And while some people might like that role because it means lots of really hot sex, for other people, that might feel like something that over the course of time would begin to really hurt and like there might be some resentment there. So I think the place you have to start is in inviting your wife's story. And it might really hurt to hear those words and to hear how she's been feeling. But you won't actually be able to start working on a resolution if you don't have those conversations and if you don't invite her perspective and her stories. Finding ways to nurture your fetish is important. For some people with fetishes, their only outlet is finding videos online. And if you get aroused from that, it absolutely counts. It counts as exploring your fetish. It counts as sex. Now, it might feel different than doing it in person. Of course, it feels different, but it does count as sex. The other thing that you might want to talk to your wife about is, what if you hired a sex worker or a pro who could be present with you around the boots? Maybe you don't interact with them sexually. Maybe you don't have intercourse with them, but maybe you work with someone who loves boots and or you pay to love boots and they wear the boots for you and they let you touch the boots and smell the boots and do whatever the things are that feel really good for you when you are around a woman in boots. And then maybe you come home and have amazing, delicious sex with your wife. That's an option. But the only way to find out if that's truly an option is to have those conversations with your wife. She's allowed to change her mind about what feels good. And the hard thing when it comes to a fetish is it can feel really terrible and scary to start losing that. And of course, it can feel aggravating and frustrating and maybe even like there's some resentment there. But the people that we're in relationship with are allowed to change their minds. They're allowed to want new experiences around their body and how you're responding to them. Maybe she just needs a break from being in the boots. And if she doesn't feel like she can actually say that to you, then I think what you end up getting is some of these excuses of maybe she really doesn't want to wear high heels. And maybe she doesn't feel like having her feet in the boot because maybe they're really hot. Maybe her feet have changed. Maybe her body's changed. You've been together for 20 years. So how are you inviting these conversations with her so that she can honestly say, like, one, I really don't feel like wearing boots right now. Or maybe she wants to wear boots, but she doesn't want it to turn into sex. Because maybe for her, they're not linked the way that they are for you. And so maybe she feels like if she wears boots, it automatically means sex. We've heard this story 1,000 times on the podcast. How many times have people written in saying that they don't even want to hug their partner or get massaged by their partner because they're afraid it's going to automatically turn into sex because it's become kind of the unspoken cue for, oh, we're going to have sex. Maybe she does want to wear boots, but she doesn't want to have it turn into sex. So there's lots of different potential opportunities here for conversations, for connection. And it sounds like either those conversations aren't being had or they're not being had in the way that gets you information. So there's no way to force your wife or to coerce your wife into wanting to do this for you. She needs to decide what feels good for her and her body, whether or not she wants to wear the boots. And then you have to decide whether or not that's something you can live with. If she's your best friend in every other way, and then there's just this one place of kind of pain and frustration, it sounds to me like there's a lot going in this relationship. And maybe you can get some help. Maybe you can work with a therapist that's sex positive or a sex coach. Maybe you can talk to her about you finding someone who's super into boots and just doing like non-sexual boot stuff and then coming home and being sexual with her. Maybe you can just acknowledge that your fetish is there and that you watch videos around it. And right now, living it out just isn't going to happen for the health of your marriage. It's not necessarily like you have to choose between them, but sometimes you do have to decide, is this thing for me more important? And if it is, then the option, of course, is to end the marriage. That's always an option. Or if this marriage is feeding you in so many ways, this is your best friend, you love each other, you feel so nurtured and sustained. And then there's this place where you have your fetish and it just feels really challenging. Then maybe you need to navigate that challenge. Maybe you need to let some time pass. Check in with her. If she's like, I just don't want to talk about this for a while, that's probably going to mean many months because there's been years of this. So give her that space and decide whether or not you can sit in that discomfort. I know it doesn't feel like there's a lot of options, but I do think that there are a lot of options for new conversations, processing feelings, finding new ways to connect, asking her what she's super into and just focusing on that for a while. Like, get creative in this space. I think the danger is when we focus on the things that aren't working, they fill up our entire lens. And I'm working with a new therapist right now who's amazing. And we are working on my trauma and my PTSD from my rapes and things like that. And one of the things that she's constantly telling me is orient towards pleasure. To instead of focusing on the things that hurt and instead of focusing on the places where there's wounds, if I instead focus on the places where I feel amazing in my body, I feel connected to my body. I feel connected to Alex. I feel joy and lit up like I'm really good at something or like I can be super playful. To really zero in on those spaces so that they fill me up and are a source of strength. Because we are not a world that allows or encourages adults to be playful and silly and to focus on the things that feel good. So that's something else I just want to offer to you, hopelessly devoted, is can you coexist with the boot fetish and the frustration and also focus on all the things that feel amazing in your relationship with your wife and in your marriage. Focus on all the things that fill you up and feed you and see if that shifts the pain a little bit. Bottom line is, lots of conversations, maybe some professional support, and definitely make sure if you reach out for professional support that you do it with someone who isn't going to shame you around your fetish. You need a sex positive therapist because there's definitely people out there who would want to focus on fixing your fetish instead of finding ways to coexist with it and then nurturing your marriage. Thank you so much for listening to the show and good luck. Here's the last email. Hi Dawn, you can call me Sad Gay Millennial. Longtime listener here. Love the podcast and the ways it has helped me and many others to whom I've recommended it process and engage our experiences with the world. Thank you. I am a gay cis male and I'm afraid of bottoming. I guess the context for this issue requires a bit of history. I have experienced repeated violations of my consent. Ranging from instances where out of conflict or fear or pressure, I've gone totally still, to instances of actively asking for it to stop and it just didn't. I attribute this to the nature of the people to whom I repeatedly make myself vulnerable, as well as such an underwhelming sensitivity, or more importantly, education among our culture about sex and consent, especially among communities prone to trauma who can sometimes go on to repeat them. But I have also experienced incredible, cathartic, painfully vulnerable, orgasmic, joyous pleasure from bottoming, both with long-term partners and one-time encounters. So I know it's possible, and even more, I miss it. Sex in general is difficult for me. I have been described as a wounded healer. In all of my relationships, I tend to assume a teacherly position where I'm guiding my partners through understanding themselves, learning about sex, pleasure, and healing, ways to heal from all of their unique traumas. I always make myself so available to undo the hurt that others have experienced and to help them feel loved and powerful, but I have never been given similar mentorship from partners. Not in such explicit ways, at least. Increasingly, I find myself feeling as though my cup is emptying, and I'm unsure if there is any way for this to ever be filled up again. The dilemma is, it's so natural and intuitive for me to understand the problems of others and to guide them towards solutions that seem so clear to me. But that same understanding for my own problems often makes itself so evasive and far away. I find myself giving mindful advice that is so pertinent to my own situations that it's almost as if part of me is talking to myself, and I can't connect that other people are, in fact, going through similar things that I have, and that should make me feel not so isolated. I appreciate my experiences for the understanding that it allows me to reciprocate with others, but even writing this now, I am crying. Because even this tiny amount of processing is breaking the surface of so much buried beneath dark, murky waters that I just cannot see through. I feel powerless, I feel alone, and at my weakest, unlovable. I know better, and that just makes my inability to do better feel worse. One solution I've tried to employ is to only sleep with people who I know and trust, but this is often difficult for a number of reasons. I'm 24 years old and struggled with homelessness between the ages of 18 to 22 after being kicked out by my family for being gay. I couldn't establish any sense of stability or purpose or belonging until I started going to school, which changed my life for the better but left me with incapacitating amounts of debt. I have traveled cities often and have repeatedly come face to face with the difficulties of any transplant. Only after about a year do I begin to secure any semblance of a social network, after a lot of effortful putting myself out there and trying, and even with my most recent and difficult move to Chicago over 2 years ago, all this time later, I am still now the loneliest I have ever been. It is so hard to find the space and the time for these types of relationships to develop that it just reaches a point of desperation where I resort to Grindr, which has almost only connected me to people who have commodified sex as a function and less as experience. I always leave these encounters feeling used, weak, and empty, and abused when come the ensuing behaviors like ghosting, gradual uncommunicated decreases in interest, or pretending we don't see or know each other in public. Several times I have contracted STIs from people who have denied it was from them, blamed me, or who I have just never heard from again. I understand the internalized stigmas and fears manifest themselves in many different ways. I just regret how disproportionate the frequency is of instances like this that are at my expense. I wish more people were brave. I wish more people were fair. Retrospectively, I see that I have bottomed for the people for whom I have felt the most vulnerable, and when eventually hurt by these people, the most devastated. I know that I physically enjoy bottoming, but all of this baggage has made it so daunting and inaccessible that I haven't done it successfully for years. I feel starved of the intimacy that I need most, as though my diet is starved of nutrients and I have been eating the bare minimum to survive. I feel far away, somehow disconnected from my pleasure. I feel invisible and unheard when everyone passes by, like a ghost among the living. Even when I hear its hollowness and the echo of my footsteps, I continue to try, but ironically, I feel the least touched after men have put their hands all over me. I know this is a bad way to say it, but I just want to feel normal. I want to be able to have sex without fear. I want to be able to bottom without all of these attachments to pain and trauma, but I simply desperately don't know how. Please help. Don't feel bad if you can't. Just writing this has made something inside of me move, like admitting it. Just the feeling that maybe someone out there cares brings me some solace. I am crying now. I just want to first say to sad gay millennial, thank you for being so eloquent in sharing yourself with us, in sharing your story and your trauma and your pain. I appreciate it so much. And so much of what I'm hearing you say echoes a lot of the things I say on this show often, which is patriarchy hurts all of us. And Audre Lorde says that the first victims of patriarchy are men. And I've talked to so many gay men who have had experiences with trauma and repeated violations of consent within the gay male community. In a large part because this hyper-masculinity, this toxic masculinity is so valued. There's this rejection of all things feminine, unless it's done in this very kind of exaggerated way. And unfortunately, as long as we exist in a world with patriarchy and toxic masculinity, there's going to continue to be this disconnect and this pain that exists within gay male culture. Andrew Gerza has talked about it at length because he encounters it all the time as someone with a disability. So first I want to say you are not alone in feeling these things. I have a very close friend who struggled for years as a gay man who just did not want to be a part of the hookup culture. And even though he would certainly use Grindr to meet people and try and go on dates, he struggled to find people who wanted a lot of the things that he did, which was a loving, caring, safe relationship outside of the endless sex that is gay culture. My first suggestion for you is find a therapist. Find a loving, nurturing, sex-positive therapist that can help you process some of your trauma. Now, I will say, as someone with sexual trauma, that oftentimes talk therapy can make trauma worse. And a lot of therapists don't like hearing that. But I am working with this fantastic therapist who is certified in somatic experiencing, which is a certification program run by Peter Levine. If you can find a somatic experiencing therapist or an SE therapist, they are specifically designed to help people work with trauma. And it is a beautiful experience of integration and patience and healing. So definitely look for that. Also, EMDR therapists do beautiful work around trauma and helping us to integrate and process trauma that's stored in our body. So what I'm hearing from you is so much pain and fear and trauma, and also a willingness to sacrifice yourself in relationships to be the wounded healer, to be the teacher, which is a way of maintaining power and distance. And of course, it comes from a place of love and wanting to help others, but it also means that you're sacrificing yourself, that you're not asking for the love and support that you need, that you're not being seen for the places where you really need someone to be your rock so that you can lean on them and break and hurt and be a mess sometimes too. As someone who has trauma and has a fat body, I have been very good at being in relationships where I got to be the caretaker, where I got to be the fixer, where I got to be the person that held things together and the other person got to fall apart and struggle and hurt, and I never got to do that myself. That's a really terrible place to be. And we all need places where we can fall apart and be messy and be wounded and be hurt and be held and loved and not rush to fix. And we can certainly find that in friends and in colleagues and in intimate partners and in therapists. There's so many places where we can be held in that way. And so I just want to encourage you, first and foremost, try and find either an SE therapist or an EMDR therapist, and also just an everyday talk therapy that can help you process so many of your feelings. Finding a sex positive therapist would be, I think, a fantastic place for you to be able to say these things and grapple with these things and to rage and to be angry and to, you know, be sad and to feel lonely, but to not have to do it alone. I also think it could be really interesting for you to potentially work with a sexological body worker or a sacred intimate. I've had TT Baum on the show. You should definitely go listen to his episode. He works with lots of gay men in these spaces, and it can be really healing to work with a professional around our wounds. They need to consent to that and to feel like that's a space they can hold for you. Certainly. We don't want to just bring our wounds to a sex worker and then expect them to fix us, like we heard with Lola Divina's episode. But there are some very skilled sex workers out there who are specifically trained to work with sexual wounds and trauma and to help people feel held and embodied in those spaces. So that might be something else that's a really powerful practice for you, where you can explore your body and your bottoming and being vulnerable with someone who has the skills and the capability to hold that space. And then I just think that when it comes to dating and finding people of quality, it can just take a long time, years sometimes, of doing our work and getting ourselves in a good place and setting better boundaries and making sure that we really only enter into relationships that nurture us and where we're equals, where we're not the caretakers, where we're not the teachers, especially when we feel like that drains us. I think the other thing too that stands out is, where is the joy? Where are the friends? Where are the places where you get to express yourself, where you get to be creative, where you get to have fun and play? Where are the places where you get to just simply be without having to do all this striving and thinking and working and struggling? Where are you expressing yourself with art or with writing? Where are you having fun just for fucking fun's sake? Because that's so healing too. Where are you silly and ridiculous and playful? Finding ways to fill yourself up through those activities and maybe taking a break from the dating and the sex can be a wonderful way to fill up that vessel you talked about feeling so empty around. And also just finding safe places to have a lot of big feelings. I know I'm not giving you very many things that are super concrete, but I think first and foremost, as someone who has so many similar experiences to what you've shared here, we have to start with ourselves. And we don't have to do it alone. We can certainly be actively finding friends and community, places where we feel seen and held because we're volunteering or we're just going to things we really enjoy. But finding therapists, working on our trauma, finding people who we just have fun with without it needing to be for sex or a relationship, those are powerful places. Those are powerful places that feed us and heal us and give us rich, nourishing food. Because I know at the end you talked about feeling so starved. And when we have those things filling us up, we are so much better able to explore sexually that vulnerability and that dating space and that relationship space, because we're better able to say, this is working for me, or I'm starting to see that some old patterns are replaying and I'm just not willing to do that anymore. But it takes having that full cup, or at least to start finding ways to plug the hole so that you can fill it up in small ways. Thank you so much for sharing yourself with us. I hope that you find safe places to do some healing and some growing. I want you to know that at 24, you have so much ahead of you, so many opportunities for meeting so many people, and it can feel hopelessly lonely sometimes, especially when we feel like we've been fighting so hard for so long. I didn't really start finding the types of relationships that were going to really fuel me until I was well into my 30s. And the friends that I had, and still have, but they're far away, the friendships that I created, the deep, nurturing, powerful friendships started coming into my life in my mid-20s. You know, I had known people for years, but to really create those amazing connections where just being in each other's presence was pure joy and fulfilling. You know, it wasn't until I was in my mid to late 20s that we really started having these powerful experiences together and making those friendships happen. Some people are lucky and find that in high school or middle school and sustain those. And others of us, because we move or because we're changing so much in who we are, it takes us a little more time. So my recommendation is find some professional support in therapy, in trauma work, maybe even with some sexological body work or some sexuality healing. And then just focus on the things that bring you joy and silliness and play. Start going to workshops and classes and events that feel like they'll fill you up, that will offer you beautiful things or funny things and surround you with people who have similar interests, and just really focus on you so that you can find the edges of who you are and what you want and what you deserve, so that you can be so clear on the things that you need help around and the things that you bring to the table, so that when you do find someone to be in relationship with, you can come to the table and say, this is what I'm looking for. Can you show up for me in these ways? And then if someone disappears or decides they don't want to be with you, of course it's going to hurt and it's going to sting and it's going to feel ouchy. That's just kind of how it is. But you won't feel like it's because of you. And that is lifelong work for some of us. So I wish you the very best, sad gay millennial. And thank you so much for trusting us with this. To everyone who listened, I have some really fun episodes coming up, including an interview with Bex Caputo, where we talk all about sex and toys and transness and being on T. I can't wait for you to hear it. If you have any questions or thoughts, you can always write to me at sexgetsreal.com. You can support the show at Patreon on patreon.com/sexgetsreal. Every dollar helps, and I will talk to you soon. Bye.